Extraordinary careers, extraordinary stories, and for the first time, they're ready to tell them. These are the Narco Warriors. In the early 1990s, Thailand was the crossroads of the global drug trade. It was where power, corruption, and survival intersected. Northern Thailand included what became known as the Golden Triangle, the lawless borderland where Thailand, Myanmar, and Laos meet. This region was one of the world's largest producers of heroin, feeding Western and Asian markets. Opium poppies grew in territory controlled not by governments, but by warlords, militias, and ethnic armies. Narco Warriors expert guest Phil Matthews, who worked in Bangkok, reveals how the risks weren't just out in the opium fields, and why the region remains at the center of a deadly trade that never really ended.
We had a gun, I turned up at the embassy, presumably to shoot me.
Welcome to Narco Warriors. Hello and welcome to Narco Warriors. Well, today we've got Phil Matthews and Graham Honey with us, and we're going to start looking at their operational lives abroad. Phil in Thailand and also Washington, and Graham in Miami and Barbados. First of all, we're going to start with Phil's experiences in Asia. Phil, when did you first go down to Bangkok as the DLO?
I went down as a DLO in late 1990, but my first operational visit to Bangkok and Southeast Asia was in early 1989 with my colleague Dave Sykes, who was later our senior DLO in Colombia and Madrid. We were out on a drugs operation. A lot of couriers were coming through London and they were transiting through Heathrow, going back out to Europe, not going through customs controls at the airport. And therefore, when they arrived in Europe, they could say they were just travelling from London. We'd arrested quite a few of them and were working our way up the chain and going to Thailand and Asia to do some operational inquiries. I remember the visit well, Linz, because the boss made us travel economy class. So we did 7 hours to the Middle East, 5 hours in the lounge, another 7 hours to Bangkok, where we met by Malcolm, our resident drug liaison officer in Bangkok at the airport, and I was bitten in the mouth by a mosquito. So my first night in Thailand was spent in Bangkok nursing home being pumped full of antihistamine. That's why I remember it really well. But this was the first time I also met General Bamroon, who was the Major General in charge of Royal Thai Police Metropolitan Narcotics Unit, which really helped the British and European agencies based in Bangkok so much, and was a fantastic friend to me and UK Limited throughout our time. We then went on to Malaysia to do some inquiries down there, take some statements, interview some people. It was important at the time because Malaysia had the mandatory death penalty for drugs. And we had a British person who was on death row down there for smuggling heroin. In fact, a guy named Derek Gregory, who was unfortunately hanged in Malaysia in 1989. Singapore also had the mandatory death penalty for drugs. So it was absolutely essential that we had good cooperation, good liaison, and strengthened our relationships with the Singapore National Police and the Royal Malaysian Police, which was one of the things which we were there to do.
Can we just come back to the situation in Thailand? One of the things at the time was it was a major source of opium, wasn't it? And you went up into the Shan provinces. And what did you find up there? The Shan provinces up on the Burmese border?
We went up to work with the Thais, looking at where they were growing poppies and where they were manufacturing heroin in heroin labs up there. If you remember at the time, there was a major war going on in Burma with a guy called Khun Sar, who led a huge militia over there. The Americans were determined to catch and convict. So there was a lot of heroin being produced up there, a lot of poppy fields up there, and we would go up there and assist the Thais in burning the poppy fields. But, you know, there's always a law of unintended consequences when you do that.
And that's, I suppose, because you burn a poppy field and you take somebody's livelihood away from them.
Yeah, we had many examples, Linz, of going up burning poppy fields, but we'd often meet the farmer, and then you realise pretty early on that this is their livelihood. And I was present on many occasions where Bamroon, the general, and maybe one or two of his guys would then give the farmer quite a lot of money to get them through the year.
That must have been a bit of a surprise when you saw that transaction.
First time it was, until he explained it to me. You know, we were destroying these people's livelihood. They didn't have an alternative way of life. The drug organisations would come over the hills two or three times a year, and they would expect their opium ready. If they didn't have the opium ready, there was repercussions. And this is all about understanding the dynamics of drug trafficking and drug production. So the reality is, if you don't control the ground, you can go in on a small scale, destroy the opium fields. It's not going to make that much difference. It's going to upset them, but it's certainly not going to cause them a major impact. So we had to look at things differently. What could we do to help the farmers? Gradually and slowly, the Thais introduced rural integrated development programs to replace growing poppies with growing coffee, growing a whole host of products. But then you've got to understand, you've got to get it to market. Well, to get it to market, you need a road. So you've got to build roads. So you have to think these things through. And the biggest thing that changed, Linz, is that the King of Thailand, King Bhumibol, really put his weight behind this, because he could see the devastation this was causing, both in terms of growing poppies, smoking opium and heroin, and decided he put his weight behind these rural integrated development programs. And over a period of 4 or 5 years, the programs absolutely transformed the area. All the heroin labs that were being at the time in Thailand, they were forced over the border. And the most important thing I learned at that time is, if you don't control the ground, you ain't going to win. It doesn't matter whether you're in South America, in Latin America, Southeast Asia. If you only go in and put resources on the ground for a short period of time, it does not help the locals. They've still got to respond to the drug traffickers, who are going to approach them with a gun at their head and say, where's my coca? Where's my opium? Where's my poppies?
So you need a strategic approach to all of this. It's not just an enforcement approach.
The Thais were really good. They did bring in that program, really supported by the Americans and the Aussies and a lot of us Europeans. But the Americans were, you know, financially the biggest committer in that area, and they did a fantastic job. And Thailand changed as a result of that.
When you mentioned what it was like on the ground, what do you remember of Bangkok as a city and as a centre for the drug trade in those early days?
Well, in those days, Bangkok, from a UK and European perspective, was attracting a lot of major drugs criminals for the lifestyle out there. Some of them lived in Bangkok, some of them lived further afield. But Bangkok was a great place to work, really interesting. We had a big community of law enforcement officers there from many different nations. We had something like 22 countries had representatives in Bangkok. The Americans alone had over 40 officers in country. We worked very closely with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Dutch National Police, the French National Police, and a number of other agencies, including the Australians, who did a lot of work in that area.
There is quite a sort of a grey area, isn't there, between the word corruption and also assistance. On occasions, you would be buying the equipment for an individual police officer, or sometimes individual police officers were actually financed by local shopkeepers and traders, because that's the only law and order they could get in a country like Thailand.
Yeah, it's different. You have to understand it from a local's perspective. And for example, a Thai police officer in uniform on traffic duty in Sukhumvit Road, one of the major roads in Bangkok, will be standing outside 8 or 9 hours a day. He was provided with his police uniform, but the locals provided him with his gun, his bullets, his waterproof jacket, his food, and lots of other things to help him get through the day, because he was supporting them. If you looked at it from a scientific perspective, that's corruption from our perspective. But we also had to pay for overtime for the Royal Thai Police, pay for their expenses, and they were really good. But yes, we provided them with a lot of equipment.
Phil, I believe there was something called Take Your Wife to Work Day, rather more unusual than the similar sort of project back in the UK. What happened when you took Paula to work?
We went up to the Golden Triangle, and the Thais would lay on some helicopters, and we would take our wives and partners out to the poppy fields, and they would see what it was actually like in the real world. And it was very, very good. We'd also visit some rural integrated development programs, meet some local people up there. And the Thais were very good, not only in doing that, but, you know, making sure that the wives understood what we were doing. So they would also take us down south on their go fast boats and see what they were doing in patrolling the south coast of Thailand.
Did they enjoy it?
Yeah, I think they really did enjoy it. It all comes with, you know, different consequences, Linz, because I remember after 2 years, my daughter was coming up to 11. We wanted to try and make sure she got into the right secondary school in the UK. And when we approached the secondary school, they said, you can't get your place, daughter a place at school because you don't live in England. And we said, well, we're posted abroad at the moment. This went on for 3 months. And in the end, my daughter had to move back to the UK and live with our best friends for 9 months so that we could have her as a residency in the UK to get her into school. Once my daughter moved back to the UK, my wife wasn't so focused on living in Thailand and spent a lot of time commuting back to the UK. And, you know, they're the sort of things that you don't always understand when you go abroad.
Now, obviously, intelligence gathering was a major part of what you were doing. There was an incident where your father and your wife, I believe, were in Bangkok, and you thought it might be a good idea to help you out because you needed to gather a particular phone number from a suspected villain. Can you tell us that tale?
Yes, if I really have to. And it wasn't one of my better days. It's the law of unintended consequences, really. I was on holiday in Phuket with my father and my wife and my kids and got a phone call out of the blue to say, could I go along and identify a new telephone number for a bar, which was owned by a guy called Michael Mescal. Michael Mescal was a long-standing drug trafficker who'd been found not guilty in the UK of smuggling a huge amount of cocaine and moved off to Thailand, where he set up store in the north of Thailand to start with, well out of our reach. We monitored him where we could. He then bought a bar down in Phuket called the Hideaway Bar, and I was asked suddenly to go along and see if there was a telephone number for the new bar. I went along, had a look at it place, and decided I wouldn't go in there. And the reason I wouldn't go in there is because I knew Michael Mescal, because he used the Hilton gym, which was very near the embassy. We were in the Hilton hotel on regular occasions because it was right next door to the embassy, so I didn't want to bump into him. So I thought it was a good idea to send my wife and my father in to get the number. So we chatted about a little cover story as to why they were in the Hideaway Bar, and off I went with my two kids on the back seat and dropped my wife and my father at the bar. They went in, chatted, had a drink in the bar, and unsurprisingly, Michael Mescal came out to greet them and asked them how they were doing and how they'd got there. And they came up with the right story. They'd got a tuk-tuk from Patong out there and they'd seen it advertised.
They're having a drink with this guy.
They're having a drink at the bar, and he joined them at the bar and was asking them a few questions. And after a while, they got the information they required and said they were going to go back to Patong, at which point he said, well, actually, I'm going there. I'll drop you there. They tried to extricate themselves from that situation, but failed miserably. And in the end, they got into his car. So I was sitting a little way down the road in what I would call a surveillance position. The car goes past and I see Michael Mescal driving, and in the back is my father and my wife, which I thought, that's
they've
a little
kidnapped. They've been kidnapped.
I had a number of thoughts going through my head. Not least was, how was I going to explain this one to London? So in tradecraft terms, it was probably the worst thing I ever did in Thailand. However, he dropped them back in Patong and we got away with that. The rather disappointing thing about that was my wife had very, very long hair at the time. And because she accompanied me to social events at the Hilton Hotel, I decided it was a good idea to have her to have a haircut. She wasn't too keen on this, but actually had to have her hair shaved off and has never let me forget it. But in the heat of the moment at the time, I thought it was the right thing to do.
Now, also, there was another extremely dangerous situation where an informant came into the British Embassy, apparently with information that he wanted to impart to you. But this all went very badly wrong, didn't it?
So, talking with the DEA and others, we were asking them if they came across any information that involved the UK, any involvement of Brits in drug trafficking, could they come to us? And very quickly, the DEA came to us and said they had an informant that was giving them information about British drug trafficking, and they thought it would be of interest to us.
So this guy came into the embassy.
He came to the embassy with a DEA guy, and the DEA guy peeled off, and he started to give my colleague and I information about a drug trafficking organisation in London, and very quickly introduced the fact that there was a corrupt customs officer in London who was closely involved with this drug trafficking.
He alleged that one of your own colleagues was corrupt.
He alleged one of our colleagues was corrupt, and he gave us very detailed information about this person. So my colleague and I spoke to him at length about it, but the story started to unfold pretty quickly when we did our checks on him. He was a convicted drug trafficker, not a very nice person. London, obviously, very interested in this. They immediately dispatched a senior officer to Bangkok, and over a week or two, we debriefed this person in extreme detail. It became very clear to us that his real motive was revenge. The officer was involved in a team that had prosecuted his colleagues, and he was there to seek revenge on that. So having decided that, we cut him off from being an informant very quickly. I told him, and he, at that stage, threatened to kill me at a subsequent time, which...
What, he actually said that to you face-to-face?
He said it face-to-face, and yeah, looked me in the eye. I looked him in the eye and, you know, took it seriously, and we took a few precautions to sort of dampen down and mitigate the threat. A few weeks later, he arrived at the embassy. We were very lucky in Thailand. We had Gurkhas guarding the embassy, and anybody coming into the embassy, particularly to see us, had to go through the Gurkhas, which meant that they were searched by the Gurkhas. The Gurkhas searched him, and they found a loaded 45 pistol on him.
So he actually walked into the British Embassy in Bangkok with a pistol in his pocket.
They did. It was concealed around his back, in fact. But yeah, he tried to get in and that to see me, and pretty glad that they didn't let him in. Otherwise, it could have been a difficult meeting, I suspect.
Was he arrested on the spot?
No, he retreated very quickly, got out of the embassy, went away.
But this is at a time when you got your wife and your children in Bangkok with you. That must have been extremely worrying.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. So they're not situations that we hadn't faced before, but this was a particularly, I think, imminent problem, because he threatened to kill me, he had a gun, had turned up at the embassy, presumably to shoot me. And what happened next was even more disturbing, because I was driving down to the embassy on a Saturday morning. I had my kids with me in the back of the car, and as I approached the side entrance of the embassy, which we would go in at weekends, this particular guy was walking towards me. So he looked straight at me. So he'd seen my car, he'd seen me, he'd probably seen the number plate of my car. It was a diplomatic plate, but easily identifiable car. And then he looked in the car and saw my daughter, who had red hair. And for me, that was particularly worrying, because there was only one international school in Bangkok. My daughter and my son went to that school. And I thought that was a real problem. Royal Thai Police take friendships very seriously. And here they felt there was a direct and imminent threat to me and my family. And I was friends with them. And their job, they assured me, was to make sure the threat went away. I don't know what other options were available to them, but they reassured me they were going to put him on a plane, and I later heard that that's exactly what happened.
You also got involved, I think, with the Queen of Thailand, I believe.
We had one interesting situation whereby Her Majesty was going on a state trip to India, had sent some presents that she was going to give on the state trip to India ahead of her, but unfortunately the plane had been diverted, and it ended up at Heathrow Airport. And I got a phone call in the middle of the night to say from the Thai police and asking me if I could help them out, and managed to grab a colleague of mine in London who went along to the airport in the middle of the night into the cargo sheds, found a couple of crates, which were the presents, managed to get a low loader, took them out to the plane, a British Airways plane, put them on the plane and sent them direct to India, and they arrived in time. And that was very gratefully received by the Royal Thai Police and others out there. A few months later, I was very, very pleased to receive an invite down to the Royal Palace in Bangkok, where I met the King of Thailand.
Going back a little bit, you mentioned there was an explosion of heroin coming out of that part of Asia long before you went to Bangkok. Why was that?
Well, heroin in that part of the world had been prevalent, number four heroin, as we called it, which was the heroin you smoked after heating it on a spoon, for example, during the Vietnam War, and that really kicked off things. So there was a huge need for it in America, North America, and they were producing lots of heroin in the Golden Triangle being Thailand, Burma and Laos, and shipping it in the late 70s, early 80s, mostly to North America to meet that drug need out there. That changed over time, where Europeans became more interested in heroin from Southeast Asia at that time. Europe was being also fed from what we called the Golden Crescent of Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan. So heroin was on the up. The traffickers were often the same traffickers who'd been smuggling cannabis to the UK and other places before. So they used, unsurprisingly, the same methodology to bring heroin to the UK and Europe and North America that they'd been using previously for cannabis. So, you know, we were well versed in that and started to find increasing amounts of heroin coming to the UK. I think in 1989, the year before I went to Thailand, we'd seized some significant amounts of heroin from Southeast Asia at Heathrow Airport and other places. On one occasion, we seized at least 60 kilos in one go. So heroin was on the increase.
Because there were a lot of, there were the kingpins in Bangkok coming over and setting up, but there were lots and lots of drug mules. But at the time, if you were caught in Malaysia or Indonesia with drugs coming through the airport, was it a mandatory death sentence?
It was the mandatory death penalty, and certainly when I went to Thailand in 1990, no person who'd ever been caught and convicted of smuggling heroin in Malaysia or Singapore ever had their sentence commuted. A British dual national, dual Australian national and an Australian national had been hanged in Malaysia 3 years before that, and we lost a British national in 1989-90 in Malaysia. So mandatory death penalty was a significant factor, and we had to manage our way around that and navigate our way through that, which we did.
Can you give me an example of one of those cases where you actually had to basically get some British smugglers off of death row?
My colleague and I would often get a call to say a British passport holder had been arrested in either in Malaysia or Singapore. Can you imagine what the situation is? You going in to interview a person who's been convicted of drug trafficking in Malaysia or Singapore and ask them to cooperate, ask them to assist you, ask them to give you information about the drug trafficking organisation that got them into that situation, and then say to him, but after you've given me all this information, you're still going to be hung. That is no incentive. And personally, I was against the mandatory death penalty for drug trafficking anyway. I could see the rationale for it for hanging certain or executing certain major drug traffickers, but in the main, they were executing drug mules. And it wasn't only Malaysia and Singapore as well. In Thailand, they had the death penalty for drug trafficking, but no foreign national had ever been executed in Thailand. They had the death penalty in South Korea. They had the death penalty in Indonesia. So for every operation we did with those agencies, we had to go in and discuss with the heads of police and usually the attorney generals or departments of justice equivalents that in this particular case, if a British national was arrested in those countries, he would not or she would not be given the death penalty. That was fine. We built up over time fantastic relations in Malaysia and Singapore that would have allowed a British person arrested or British national or British citizen arrested in those countries and possibly facing the death penalty to be put on a plane with a couple of the local officers, and we would attempt to do a controlled delivery, get him out of the country.
When you first got to Bangkok, you went to a particular conference in Beijing. Could you just tell me about that, why it was so important in terms of building relationships with other agencies?
Yeah, I went out to Thailand to take up my post in late 1990. A little bit earlier in the year, Chief Investigation Officer, the Director Investigation, had sent me to what's called a Heads of National Drug Law Enforcement Agency meeting in Beijing, where all the heads of police agencies, particularly their drug sections, were in Beijing for a major conference. For me, it was fantastic because I got to meet not only the heads of national law enforcement agencies, I met the heads of the drug agencies. I learnt a little bit about politics because the first day I arrived, I had the Hong Kong delegation sitting with us on the UK delegation, and the Chinese told me straight away that they didn't recognise the Hong Kong delegation. So that was a good starter for 10. But I have to say that the Chinese ran a fantastic conference. It's a five-day conference every day, dealing with things from mutual cooperation and assistance, extradition, cooperation, drug trafficking, drug production, sharing of intelligence, controlled deliveries.
There must be a lot of frustrations in law enforcement in terms of the job that you do and restrictions that you find and cases you can't quite make. But when you look back on your time in Bangkok, do you regard that as a success? It sounds like it was.
Yeah, I think so. You know, just to put it in perspective, when Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister, she was on a trip to Malaysia and someone asked her, what do you think of the mandatory penalty for drug trafficking, Mrs. Thatcher? And she said, pays your money, takes your chance. When John Major came in, I think it was 1990, the first telex we received in Bangkok was, you're no longer to work with the Singapore and Malaysian narcotics agencies on drugs operations. That gave you a spin of the politics, but we were able to navigate our way through
that. Did that come direct from John Major, then, from the Prime Minister?
It came from the Prime Minister's office, yeah. And, you know, understandably, to a certain extent, he'd seen the fact that Derek Gregory had been hanged in Malaysia for heroin trafficking and didn't want any other Brits executed. I absolutely understood that. But we still had to work with these people because we had Brits living in these places, travelling to these places. We had a lot of Brits who travelled to Singapore to meet other drug traffickers because they thought it was a safe environment for meetings. So we needed to work with the host agencies to get their support.
So the work still continued with these agencies?
Yeah, and it still continues today. I think the difference today is that we've still got liaison officers posted overseas, but we haven't got so many liaison officers that have got a deep, broad understanding of drug trafficking, covert policing, and technical operations. So they're much more pure liaison officers and not intelligence officers, which is quite sad and disappointing, really, because we've spent many years building up our relationships with these countries and they respected us for our knowledge and understanding and what we brought to the table. That still goes on in many countries, but in other countries that's less so, which is disquieting in my view.
And finally, where does Thailand fit into the global drugs jigsaw today? What's the difference? Is it still a major part of the international drugs trade?
Well, Southeast Asia certainly is, and Thailand's a pivotal place for it. We still have serious organised criminals living and operating from Thailand. They're not all involved in drug trafficking. And also you have to remember that with drug trafficking, it's inextricably linked to associated money laundering. So we have a lot of people drug traffickers and serious criminals who've invested money in Thailand and Southeast Asia. They like to live there. They like to go there. And drug production hasn't gone away. Hasn't gone away because we don't control the ground in Burma and we don't control the ground in Laos. Where they grow opium and where they have heroin labs are very remote places. And unless you control the ground, it's never going to work. But in Thailand, they do control the ground most of the time and it's a much better situation. But it hasn't gone away. And it won't go away, but we need to continue to maintain operational activity out there and mitigate the risk of Brits being arrested in that region for smuggling drugs.
I think it's well worth mentioning that over the last 4 or 5 months, there have been a spate of couriers being arrested coming from Thailand with cannabis. And I think that was down to the fact that the Thais had actually relaxed their laws in Thailand on possession of cannabis. So the couriers were going out there thinking they were safe and immune and then coming back to the UK and getting caught. My understanding is that the Thais have now repealed the laws out there. And as Phil said, I think it shows the flexibility of what the Thais are like and how quickly they'll react because they don't want the problem there, and they could see this was going to cause them a problem. So they've repealed that law.
Yeah, it's a good point, Graham. When you relax those laws on personal use, depending on what figures you put in there, you know, it often becomes a magnet for some of the most undesirable people, but also for drug trafficking organisations. So trying to get the message over to young people particularly not to travel to Southeast Asia as a drugs courier is tough. Some of them do appear to get the wool pulled over their eyes, but the reality in my 38 years, I never met a courier who didn't know what they were doing. I met quite a few couriers who didn't want to believe, i.e. they closed their eyes to the obvious. They thought they were smuggling emeralds or jewels or money, etc. But the reality, if they was asked the right questions, they know exactly what they were doing. I'd never met a lorry driver who's got half a ton of heroin on him who didn't know he was carrying it. Drug traffickers do not trust people they do not know with their drugs. So they might try to, as I say, pull the wool a little bit over the eyes of people, but the reality is they like to control it. So it's another factor. So if you're a young person out there thinking of going out to Southeast Asia or anywhere to pick up anything which you think is illegal and you're being asked to smuggle it, think about it. The consequences can be catastrophic, not just for you, but for your family.
Very wise words that I hope somebody listening might actually take on board if they're intending to go out to Southeast Asia for a bit of adventure. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Next time on Narco Warriors.
I hear a shot fire out, and then all hell let loose.
An idyllic posting in Barbados begins with a gunfight and a dead body on a tropical beach.
Everything goes smoothly until you actually engage with the enemy.
Miami becomes the Clapham Junction of the global drug trade. And how a small piece of intelligence caused shock, disbelief and consternation among the narco warriors as the drug smugglers swamped Europe with enormous cargoes of cocaine.
The intelligence was that the vessel was going to sail right up the River Thames with the drugs on board.
That's coming up next time on Narco Warriors. Join us again soon.